be a legal discussion. Yeah.
The meeting of the Public Institution Committee of the Public Commission in North Fletcher will come to order. We do have a quorum present with four commissioners, four members of the committee being present. Welcome, everyone, and thanks for attending. Purpose of today's meeting is to hear a presentation and committee discussion on nepotism and hiring practices in the Legislative Assembly, followed by a work session of the committee. The staff and committee have identified a number of proposals that we hope we might be able to dispose of today as we focus the attention of this committee on issues of importance. We'll begin this morning with the presentation from Dave Henderson, Legislative Administrator, on hiring practices. My friend Gert Boyle, Dave, says that nepotism is okay as long as we keep it in the family. So,
nepotism is such a dirty word. We don't like that word. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Henderson. I'm the Legislative Administrator, and I'm here this morning to announce my candidacy for governor of the state.
I'm sorry.
I love it.
Okay.
I'm glad.
Okay, plan B then. You have in your possession a memo that we put together that looks like this, which describes the number of people that we are aware of who are family members of legislators. As you probably are aware, there are no restrictions at this time on legislators hiring members of their family. At the same time, we do not inquire of legislators or staff people whether they are whether the legislator is hiring a family member or whether the person who comes in and has been hired is a family member. So the numbers that are reflected in this memo are based on self-disclosure because we have no way other than that of tracking this. So in other words, the memo says that there are 13 family members employed by the 30 senators and 24 family members employed by the 60 representatives. That's to the best of our knowledge. There actually could be more. But if a person doesn't come in and say, I'm going to work for my husband, wife, father, mother, son, daughter, we have no way of knowing. And we would not assume.
Without last name. I mean, last names would obviously be a hint.
It would be a hint. Yeah, so. But as you know, there are many cases where the person who is working has a different last name than the legislator. So it is conceivable that there may actually be more than are there.
But it's pretty common knowledge, isn't it, that someone is someone's obviously spouse and or mm-hmm. son, daughter.
It is. I'm not aware of anyone ever trying to hide anything
right.
like that. And that really is the information that I can present. I'd be happy to answer questions and go into greater detail about any items that you would like to hear about.
I know, Dave, that since I worked in the legislature, and I recall back in the late 70s, early 80s, that the members also had hired committee staff. And that's no longer true. Is that correct that you hired committee staff?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The process for hiring committee staff has changed a number of times over the years. The current process is one that involves myself, the manager of the committee services unit, the human resources manager for our agency, and then representatives of each of the four different caucuses. So there are basically a seven-member interview panel. We interview all applicants for committee administrator positions, and then we work with the committee chairs and the leadership offices to match expertise areas and personalities and styles so that we staff committees that way. The chairs don't have that ability, as they did at one time, to go out and hand-pick candidates for the positions.
Are there any committee staff administrators or support staff that are related to legislators, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chair, there were during the 05 session, mm-hmm. but there are not any right now that I'm aware of.
And did any of them work directly for their relatives?
No, sir. Okay.
Feel free, any other...
Could I ask an unfair
Please.
Question?
Yeah.
Unfair question, but can you characterize from your history and perspective here issues related to family members being in staff roles for legislators or committees?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Schuette, I think one thing that is very important and that we hear frequently from legislators is that the family member probably knows the district as well as the legislator, or nearly as well as the legislator. And a family member often has the complete trust of the legislator. And those are critical things to having an effective staff person in your office. If you've got a person working for you who knows the issues facing your district, knows the district, knows you as a legislator, I think you can make a case that they can be more effective than somebody who was hired perhaps without that internal or that inside knowledge.
Speaking from my experience, Commissioner Schutte, having worked in the session and having worked with a spouse of a legislator, I worked 3 sessions for Representative Bill Markham, and his wife, now late wife, Jean, worked for him for all 3 sessions I was with him, and for the total time he was in the legislature, which was a dozen sessions or so. And it's, to me, it made perfect sense. I mean, they do come up here for 6 months. It's a hardship for them to come up here and to bring their spouses. And Jean knew the district every bit as well as Bill, and knew who the people were and who needed to get in touch with him. And they're obviously not making a fortune. So I didn't see anything wrong with having the spouses or relatives work for them. What I am concerned about, Debbie, did you represent
Bill? I'll wait till you finish.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to throw in my 2 cents. Is my daughter works for me part-time, and it's the only way she can. She has to have another job and has a child and lives in the district, but obviously born and raised in the Seaside area, and is a very good writer, and she does all my constituent work and is very good at research. And what Dave said, the 2 points he made, is having someone you trust. I can leave a file of to-do on her porch on my way to town if I'm going that way, or send it with her dad, who can drop it off, or email to her, and she can just drop it off, has a key to the house. And, you know, we don't have enough money to have a separate office space, so my office, when it's not in my car, is in our home. And I feel much more comfortable having my daughter coming in and out of the home when I'm not there, which is often. And then the trust factor, too, is just I know it's going to get done, and I can call her at 6 in the morning because she gets up at 5 like I do, and we can just do our business there before she goes off to her other job. So it does work out.
Commissioner Herring?
I think it might be worth mentioning, too, that as legislators have mentioned to me, that during the long time when they're not in Salem, as my colleague just mentioned, when the staff member is then as part of the household, that makes work during the interim smoother, I think. But the question really arose most recently. I mean, it's come up every 2-3 years for the last 30 years that I know of. And everybody points out that, or somebody points out that a number of relatives work in the legislature, and everybody says, ho hum, and then they go on. Came up most recently in a more controversial way, as you know, and that is because a particular legislator was reported to have increased the pay of her relative to a large, in a big way. What are the ways to prevent that sort of abuse?
And building along that, that's what I've been thinking out loud with committee staff, committee chair, since the story broke, the Kellyworth story broke, and over the mother. Is there a way where if someone, thinking out loud here, if someone were to have a relative on their staff, that if they did make a salary adjustment, that it would have to be analyzed, approved by a nonpartisan professional administrator such as yourself?
Chair Timchek, Commissioner Herring, there are discussions underway, I know, in the Senate leadership and the House leadership right now on ways to limit the ability of legislators to do that. At this point in the rules, I know in the House, and I have not reviewed the Senate rules, but I believe they're very similar, the appointment authority and the authority to establish the salary of employees is in the House and Senate rules. So barring a change in those rules, I'm not sure that anything could be done right now. Certainly, there are a couple of different proposals that I think will come out next week as the Senate meets for executive appointments for the Senate to amend its rules. The House can't do that until they come into session, which will obviously either be when they come in for a special session, if there is one, or the next regular session. But at this point, there's nothing administratively that could be done. It would take a change in the House or Senate rules right now.
But if this committee or the full commission on the legislature were to recommend, obviously this commission, as you know, has really no real power except the power of the pulpit, and hopefully the legislators will listen to our recommendations. But if we were to recommend a change in the House rules and Senate rules to create some sort of situation where, again, hiring anyone, increasing the salary by a relative, at all or by more than a certain percentage, without the approval, would that such a recommendation, if enacted, be awkward for the legislative administrative services, or is it doable?
Mr. Chair, it would be very awkward to put, for instance, the legislative administrator in a position of having to approve that. Mm-hmm. Certainly putting either of the presiding officers in that position would be, I think, a more viable option, right, because it should be a legislator who is granting that authority,
right,
rather than a staff person, in my opinion.
Mr. Herring.
What about the possibility of simply setting a schedule for staff compensation that would be abided by anybody, regardless of what the circumstances are?
Chair Timchuk, Commissioner Herring, certainly that's a possibility. And the budget for the offices is based on a set salary. For instance, during a session, the member's allowance is based on hiring one person at about $2,300 a month and another person at around $1,900 a month. So,
but they can hire one person at $4,200 a month.
They certainly can.
Okay.
And they can actually take the additional money that is appropriated for expenses and put that into payroll as well. And I think the point is, it's an intense 6-month period, and you've got to give each legislator as much flexibility as possible to manage that budget the way that works best for them. Some legislators are going to work best by having one person there that they can go to for everything. Others maybe are going to prefer to have two or three or four or however many people there. But certainly putting them on a schedule would be one option. The interim allowance that they get is based on one staff person making $1,846 a month. But again, if they have money carried forward from the legislative session, they can actually pay more than that.
And that was how Representative Worth was able to increase the salary to whatever it was for her mother.
That's my understanding, yes. Plus, we have made one change that you should be aware of, because this has come up a couple of times in recent years when legislators have resigned midterm, and perhaps they have paid a staff person either more than was budgeted or less than was budgeted. And so we had situations in the past where when a member left midterm, the practice used to be that the incoming member, the new member, would assume whatever balance was left in the departed member's account. And that really, it was not fair either way, because if the departing member had overspent, then the new member coming in got less money than his or her colleagues. If the departing member had been very frugal and not spent as much, then the member coming in got more money than his or her colleagues. So there was a decision that has been implemented administratively by the presiding officers that if a member leaves midterm now, the incoming member gets a prorated amount based on what is budgeted for that office. So if the departing member has spent more than the $1,846 a month, that doesn't matter. The new member gets $1,846 a month.
To your knowledge, Dave, have you surveyed other states as to whether legislative assemblies, whether they allow hiring of relatives?
Mr. Chair, no, we have not. But we could certainly check into that through NCSL. They have a number of surveys they conduct on a regular basis, and we could find out.
If you could, and report back to Marjorie.
Certainly.
Mrs. Lindy. Mr. Anderson. Assume that we're not concerned about this, assume that we're persuaded that there are very good reasons for putting family members on if they serve well. Is there a potential risk with respect to family members that does not exist with respect to people you're hiring in a labor market, and that is that you will wink at whether how much work they actually do? Nothing doesn't happen, but is there a risk? Because the money goes into the family coffers, and, you know, if your college kid is busy studying for exams and he's not going to be at work, so what?
And building on what Justice Lindy said, there is no supervisor besides the representative or senator. They're the only one who really supervises the...
Yeah.
Chair Tim Chuck, Chair Lindy, certainly there's a risk of that. At the same time, I'm aware of situations of spouses working for members, and the spouses may be being paid $1,000 a month, and they're working 50, 60 hours a week for that member.
No, I understand that.
So you're absolutely right. There is that risk, but there's also the other side of that.
I'm not being critical of anybody. Mm-hmm. I agree. People who do this kind of work, and I was a staff member in my day, and yeah, we worked 12 hours a day, and it didn't reflect in the pay. I'm just talking about the idea that it might be reassuring, perhaps, to the public. If there was somebody who actually, I mean, if somebody just submitted timesheets to somebody other than the legislator.
And in fact, that is one item that is under discussion right now, because at this point, personal staff to legislators do not submit timesheets on a monthly basis, as the rest of the employees in the legislative branch do. And we are discussing whether those should be required.
Would it be helpful if this committee recommended that?
It certainly wouldn't hurt.
Mr. Yes. Chair, can I just say something in defense of as a legislator? I mean, we are elected to do this job. It is at low pay and high hours, and there is some. It seems to me there should be some sense of trust in the members to do what's right. And you know, let me tell you from personal experience, if my staff doesn't do my work and I've got to do it, it adds to my level of. That's why you have staff, is so that you can be more efficient in the position. And it's a little bit offensive to me. It would be a little bit offensive to me to have to report to someone else. I mean, if I'm not doing my job, that means I'm not representing my constituency, and that will reflect at the ballot, I would imagine. You know, if I'm not doing a good job, and if I'm not doing a good job because I can't do the work all by myself, and my staff isn't doing it, it's incumbent on me to discuss this with my staff and say, look, you know, either you do this or I'll have to find someone else. And even when that's a family member, that can be tough, I'm sure, for some people. But the point is that we have to get the job done, and you need staff to do it. You have to delegate certain things, otherwise your time is spent shuffling papers. And I do all my own email, and I will write personal notes to people sometimes when a response doesn't require research or anything like that. But the letters that go to people, congratulations on reaching the honor roll or graduation for all college students that we get sent to us by the university system, my staff does that. And I will write a personal note on many of those, and she will too if she knows them, because if they're from the district, she knows them. Letters that require extensive research into agency activities, she handles that with assistance from the legislative liaisons we have at the agencies. And often what I'm doing at the end is a phone call, email, or a small note, personal note, just to make sure everything was done and the follow-up is complete. And if I have to then keep a little record of every 20 minutes here, 15 minutes there, or my staff does, that gets real cumbersome in the amount of time that's left to do the actual work. Long thing. And I understand, Judge Lindy, what you're saying as a reassurance to the public, but I think that it's incumbent on me to make sure that my constituents are handled or addressed, their issues are addressed completely, and I do follow up, you know, when I know I may slip through the cracks on some, but we pretty much handle everything like that, and we don't keep track. We do what it takes as long as it takes and get it done. So,
Dave, share with this committee for the record. It obviously is difficult to find. You're putting a job description down for working for the legislature. It's like, hey, would you like to work 6 months every other year? For, you know, it's tough finding the right people to work here. And for committees, I'm sure, as well as for personal staff, if you could broadly stereotype the typical legislative staffer that is hired for committee, is it, you know, many of them are students at Willamette, there's a lot of interns who come up here? Where do you find the staff to staff the committees, to staff offices?
Chair Timchuk, it's interesting because we, yes, it's difficult. At the same time, we get some fantastic people coming in here who work here who are so overqualified. We're fortunate to have them here. We get, you're right, a lot of students will come over and work. We get a lot of people who are just fresh out of college and they are in a position to do this kind of a job for 6 months. We get a lot of people who are career change people. They've maybe worked at an agency or in private business or somewhere for 10 or 15 or 20 years, and they're trying to figure out what do I want to do for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years. And this is an opportunity. They can come in here and do this for 6 months, meet a wide variety of people, make a lot of valuable contacts, and maybe even gain a position going out of here that way. There are a number of people who, because of their circumstances, are able to do this job for 6 months and then in effect take 18 months off or go do something else and then come back and do it for another 6 months, either for the same legislator or a different legislator. There are a lot of I guess you'd say professional personal staff people who are able to cycle in and out of the process that way. So we're very fortunate that way.
Mr. Kim?
Yes.
I do want to follow up on this point. I'm glad to hear that that's still going on. I'm reminded that my wife, who had worked at the Supreme Court and had worked for a U.S. Senator, when she came to Eugene with us, drove back and forth, got up at 5:30 in the morning to come as a staff person for Nancy Fadley because she was friend of Nancy Fadley's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that she didn't need the job.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't looking for another job, but she knew how to do that job.
Mm-hmm.
And she wanted to do it because she was interested in what the legislature does. So I want to switch to one other thing. Somebody else has a question on this, but before I forget it, two things. One, if timesheets are too burdensome, there would be some other form of certification that something that would be at least taking a position on the record. Yes, I can assure you that somebody has put in 60 hours a week, 40 hours a week, whatever, on my staff, and that should do it. I just want something that puts the legislator on public record that says, okay, I know this person's actually doing the work. Timesheets are just one mechanism. I don't care about the mechanism. What I want you to think about later, though, is I want to get back to the professional staff, but let's finish with this nepotism thing first.
Commissioner Herring.
Just a question. Dave, do you know people who work for legislators, including their relatives, are they considered to be exempt status under labor law?
Chair Timchuk, Commissioner Herring, yes. The entire legislative branch is exempt.
Including
personal staff.
Clerical staff and so on.
Mm-hmm. Personal staff who are of a clerical nature are exempt, yes. Our staff of a clerical nature are not exempt, but personal staff are exempt.
Okay.
As you know, Dave, one of the big topics this commission is looking at is annual sessions or some change to a Washington state-like model, the 60 days, 90 days. Knowing you as I do, I'm sure you've begun to think about how that would impact on you, on the legislative administration, on staff. Can you share some early thoughts on that? Or
Chair Timchuk, actually, I'm not in a position to share anything right now, but you are correct. We are working on that right now. We're developing some models that can be considered by the commission should there be an effort to go to annual sessions, as far as how the cycle of those sessions would change the staffing needs of the legislature, both personal staff and professional staff. So we're working on that, but I don't really have anything to...
Do you know how Washington State does it?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. Justice Lindy?
Well, I'm going to this specific...
Any other questions on this?
That's
the general topic?
Deal first with any questions.
No, go ahead.
On relatives, anybody? No. I want to turn to professional staff at Sitchin. Are you going to be testifying also to the committee I'm on this afternoon, the Structure and Functions and Process Committee, do you know?
Commissioner Lindy, I'm not scheduled to.
Okay, well then let me ask the question now because it's going to be interesting to us. I take it that professional staff are enjoined to be impartial, nonpartisan, not take policy positions, all right?
Correct.
Yeah. And that's if you have a professional staff that's working for the legislature and not in any relationship to a particular member, that makes sense. Larger legislators, and certainly the Congress, have majority-minority people because one side will say, well, now you may think that's an accurate analysis, but we doubt that, and they can't turn them in. And you get very little, I mean, given the nature of our staffing and here in our committees and so on, there's very little in the way of getting real in-depth policy analysis out of a staff director. I mean, that's they're essentially responding to whatever the committee chair and so on is putting on the day's agenda, but as far as going out and collecting information that may support one or the other policy positions concerned, they don't do that, do they?
Chair Kemchuk, Commissioner Lindy, to an extent that does happen, but you are correct in that a lot of the work is driven just on a day-to-day basis,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we don't have the resources to do a lot of independent, in-depth research on topics and bring back reports of that nature. There are...
And even if it's not original research, if it is a matter of going out and collecting... See, but I have the impression, I'm just watching, I've never served in this body, that people get a lot of information submitted by the lobbyists, by outside people who come in. You've got to do this because it'll have these consequences and it'll do the following things to us and we'll be out of business or your community will suffer or whatever it is. Somebody may say, well, you know, I doubt that. And so the question about how much help substantive members of substantive committees can get from their staff is a troublesome question for me. I mean, in a larger, I know from experience, in a larger body, it's taken for granted that there's somebody that the two sides can turn to collect the material who have a policy position.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do for that?
Well, Commissioner Lindy, there are policy analyst positions in the presiding officer's offices and in the caucus offices. So where mm-hmm. the professional committee staff that are employed by our agency or the professional staff in legislative revenue or legislative fiscal are tasked with providing the nonpartisan information, a lot of times a member can take that information, okay. turn it over to the staff person in the caucus office and say, okay, now let's hear the Democratic perspective on this. Let's look at the Republican perspective on this. I want to take this information and steer it this direction policy-wise. So there is some staff available for that.
Mm.
And certainly some of the personal staff do a fair amount of that work as well.
See, the reason this is important to us is one of the things on the agenda. I'm glad to hear that. That's interesting information. But one of the reasons we're concerned about it is because the whole idea of caucuses and partisanship is also on the agenda. And so the question about where should this function of policy-driven analysis be located in the legislature is a very interesting question to us.
Mm-hmm.
I say, not really this committee, but since you're not going to schedule to appear the other one, we may have to ask you to come.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
I would note the presence that just came in of Commissioner Lang, who is chair, David, you know, of the process committee, which is the committee looking over the annual session question. And Jenny, we just had a conversation with Dave about, and he said that they have begun to, legislative administration, to look ahead and to think and to prepare reports and analysis of what a move to annual sessions would do to staffing here at the legislature and how they would handle that. So, other questions from committee members? So, Dave, Commissioner Yoshida.
If you don't mind.
That's all yours.
Some country overseas have a central information center, the research center, non-partisan group, and the very highly confidential. And any party can ask them any question, very highly confidential organization, and they can research for those people who request it. And I see in Oregon, just knowing a little bit, that each caucus or party have their own, and they try to ship to where they want it, the interpreter. And a lot of time now that they're wasting so many time and so many manpower. And as Commissioner said, that sometimes they listen to their lobbyist opinions more than what those people know how they dig in. But is there any system like this that exists in the Oregon history for those central information research organizations?
Chair Kinchuk, Commissioner Yoshida, I think one of the challenges that that we encounter on a regular basis in that way is legislative council staff enjoy attorney-client privilege with the legislators that they're working with. So they cannot reveal if they are working with one legislator on a certain issue. But our staff don't have that that privilege. Mm-hmm. So every bit of research that we do is in effect a public record. So we don't enjoy that same confidentiality that that some other offices do. That presents can present challenges for mm-hmm. us, and it's something that we struggle with because we don't go out and advertise that we're doing something. But if there was a public records request, we would have to respond to that and reveal information that perhaps a legislator didn't want to have revealed. So I don't know if that addresses your question, but that's something that has impacted our staff, and we conduct training on that, and it's an ongoing challenge for us.
It's a lot of waste going there.
And on the issue of committee staff that Justice Linda raised, Congress, of course, which is full-time, obviously, full-time staff, every committee has a majority staff and a minority staff. And that's different here, perhaps uniquely different in the Oregon legislature, that the committee staff you hire, their requirement is to work for all the members. Is that correct?
So. That's correct. They're employed by our committee, but they are tasked with working with the entire, and when I say our committee, I mean the Legislative Administration Committee. But they work for all of the members of whatever committee it is they're assigned to. They work at the direction of the chair, but if a minority member of the committee comes to that staff person and says, I want you to research this for me, which is 180 degrees opposite of the direction that the committee chair wants to go, that staff person will do that research. But it can put them in an awkward position.
Slightly off topic before we let you go, Dave, I think one of the issues this committee has discussed that we might focus on at a later hearing is training, and whether the training of the staff and of the legislators is adequate, effective. So put your thinking cap on now. I think we'll see you later in the year on that issue. Do you have any initial thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, we have... I've been involved in conducting training since the 97 session, and we refine our agenda every 2 years based on the input that we get coming out of the previous sessions. We involve the caucus offices, and we block time for the caucus offices to do training with incoming staff because we know that they want to give them direction on certain things that would not be appropriate for us to do. So we do a pretty thorough 2-day training with incoming staff that is of a general nature. And then as far as our committee staff, we have basically a week-long training process for them. So it's pretty extensive and pretty thorough, but certainly we're always looking at ways to improve that.
I'd be interested in knowing, too, and perhaps before we discuss that, you could find out the general percentages of returning staff per session. You know, how many people in the 2005 session had worked in previous sessions? That might
sure.
be helpful for this committee in discussing training, because I suspect a pretty heavy percentage had prior experience.
We can research that.
Okay. Commissioner Boone.
And I'd like to say thank you to Dave and his crew since 97 for having this training available, because I spent 8 sessions as a legislative assistant,
And you started when you were 16, obviously. So.
Thanks. No, I'm an old broad. I'm going to be 55 in a few months.
Wait a minute. What does that make me?
Well, I'm just saying that for me. But I remember even as much as I spent, the time I spent in this building, I went to all the trainings pretty much and always learned something new. And then once they started this new intensive one, I still went, and I was really happy because it took the pressure off me as someone a lot of the LAs would come to because I'd been here for a while, and not that I didn't enjoy doing that mentoring role. It did become kind of cumbersome at times. So these guys do a great job. I hired a staff this last session who came from Willamette and was a district boy, and I said, you really should go through it. He asked, do I need to? And I said, you really should. And you know what? It was so good, he only asked me two questions all session. Wow. On process. Mm-hmm. So they do a great job.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Dave, as always, for being here.
So you're very welcome.
So we do have an opportunity here now for public comment on hiring practices in the Legislative Assembly. I knew there were some members who are interested in attending and might be coming later. Is that correct, Marjorie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think they would have been here by now if they were interested in attending.
Right. And no members of the audience here are here to testify or comment on that topic? Okay, thank you.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I would like to point out that we did receive a letter from Jim Santee. But it's on a particular proposal.
Yes.
At which time we aren't exactly taking public testimony, but I told him I would certainly provide that to the board.
We'll proceed now ahead of schedule, which we'd like to be, to the next item of agenda on this for this committee. I had asked Administrator Taylor to go through some of the many recommendations that had come into the full commission and that had been later been assigned to the purview of this committee to bring up today for us to discuss and perhaps to make a decision as to whether or not we should continue to consider them. The chairs of the commission, Judge Pryor and Mr. Wilhelms, would, I think, appreciate it if we began the process of narrowing the focus of each committee, seizing on the ideas that we will continue to talk about in the life of this commission. Marjorie, any other comments on the? I assume other committees are doing the same thing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Other committees are taking off some of the proposals that are really quite general in nature, or the concepts behind some of those proposals are incorporated in other proposals that the committees will take up later on. I've provided for each of our committee members a table of the proposals that remain in committee. The first table identifies those that you might consider removing today, but then I've divided the remaining into three significant categories: public access issues, training and ethics, and intergovernmental relationships. And those that you might remove today, I think the concepts are included in other proposals later on, or they're proposals that perhaps you just don't want to spend time on altogether. Such as, say, proposal number 35, where it was originally stated as increasing public confidence in the legislature, review public relations and image. I think that is exactly what this committee and the full commission are doing. So, for instance, this committee can make a recommendation to the full commission that the committee and the commission take no further action on proposal number 35, but it's inherent in the work of the commission.
Correct. I mean, but it is the intent of the, I see Commission Chair Wilhelms with us today, and Commission Chair Wilhelms, it is the intent of the commission that each proposal that came from somebody and that got to this commission be dealt with, either disposed of or...
That's correct.
And that's what the other committees are doing as well, so...
I hope so.
Yes, they are.
Yes, they are. All right, we'll proceed then now, unless there are any objections or comments or suggestions, to go through the list that Administrator Taylor has prepared. And we'll begin with number 035, which was a proposal to increase... that this commission should increase public confidence in the legislature.
It seems to me, as our administrator has just pointed out, this really is not anything we ought to have on a list. That's the whole point of
correct.
It comes as a consequence of whatever else we might be able to recommend if we're successful. So I think as a point of work, it makes no sense to have that on there. It's the overall goal.
Correct. Are there any objections to removing that from
scratch?
You can back it. So that proposal number 35 has been disposed of. Proposal number 61 is to examine the role of caucuses and whether their meetings should be open to the public. Mr. Taylor, any comments on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, this was one of those proposals where we had just one statement submitted, and again, that was examine the role of caucuses and whether their meetings should be open to the public. I did note that in Senate Rule 2.30, there is a policy for open caucus meetings, and perhaps you're aware from news reports that the Senate Democrats do have open caucuses to the media. Other caucuses in this building do not have open caucus.
Commissioner Herring.
It seems to me that this point bears directly on the goal that we just disposed of in number 35. My sense is that the public perception of the legislature is that there's a good deal of sneakiness going on and a good deal of shadowy activity that diminishes the trust that people may have in the legislature. To the extent that that's true, I think one of the contributing factors is that the caucuses do the work they do the way they do it. So I think this is a critical point, and I think the committee eventually, maybe the whole commission, ought to recommend that greater openness prevail in this caucus process. And I think that this point is a very important one. We ought to make sure to keep it on the list.
Okay. Other thoughts?
I heard that some Democrat people told me that since they opened up to the public, that a public official didn't speak up. And then meeting is over, they start discussing something else on it.
No, I think this is Commissioner Hearn is right. This is an issue of some controversy with point of views on both sides, strong point of views on both sides. And I think if we were to have a hearing focusing on this, we'd have a lot of thoughts and testimony from members as to whether they thought it worked or didn't work. So yeah, I think we should keep this on the agenda for further discussion down the line.
I'd support that and see how it fits with the process committee as well.
92 sounds similar. Open the budget process, no closed door sessions. A member of the public suggested keep the budget process open, maintain open meetings laws, and not have closed door sessions other than for personnel matters. Local governments have to do this, and that's one reason we the people believe in our local governments and not in the shenanigans that go on in Salem, according to the proposal. Not my personal opinion, of course, but one that was submitted to the committee. That seems to be caught up in the same thing as 61, essentially, wouldn't it be? Or
well, I think so. My guess, I'm sorry, I don't really know to what extent the budget process is not open.
Exactly. The hearings are open. I think they're referring to the caucuses or meetings at the end.
Yeah, I think we ought to dispose of it because
it's inherent in 61, I think.
It is. So. I think we ought to stress whenever we get the chance that the legislative process ought to be open completely, all aspects of it. And so I think the caucuses are covered by that, and anything else that the legislature does would be covered as well. So I don't think we need a separate item for budget process.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Lindy.
I would just like to have somebody pursue this with respect to the situation in which the people on the committee cannot reach agreement between the two houses, and what happened this last session, where it seems to me there were 3 or 4 days, as I recall, in which nothing much happened, while ultimately the majority leaders or the presiding officers in two houses went off and cut a deal. Do you think that should be an open process?
Well, I think so.
How would you make it open?
I think going back to the point of what we're trying to talk about, and that is to make the legislature work better and thereby to increase its public standing. And it seems to me that all these kinds of tricks, all these shenanigans, all the sort of stuff like one house adjourning, the other one not, and all of that detracts from, I think, the public image, frankly, from the work of the legislature. And so we ought to the extent that we can get a grip on some of those things, we ought to talk about
them. Oh, I think we should talk about it. I agree with you. I'm going beyond talking about it later and just asking. Here's, seems to me, just as an observer, it's a simple kind of problem. Sooner or later, sometimes, whether it's the presiding officers or whether it's chairs of two committees or something like that, and they're in a situation where they must take an action and they have opposing views and so on. They're not people who are charged with legal responsibility. They're not personally given extra decision-making power. But in practice, they have to settle what they're going to do. And the idea of saying, well, they have to do it openly, I just want to see how that would work. Because if you go off and you say, look, come over to my house tonight, or have lunch together, or let's come in here on Saturday and just sit around and really go over the numbers and just fight it. It's not calling something shenanigans or just using a pejorative term for it. It sort of feeds into the public suspicion, but how do you resolve it?
Well, I think how you resolve it is to let the public, or let the sunshine of openness, I guess, if you want to put it that way, shine on the processes that go on in this building. So that when a caucus meeting, for example, decides that, look, this is a good bill, but we're not going to support it. We're going to hold it hostage because we want the other side to do this. And they're not going to do it until we hold this bill hostage. And don't talk to anybody about this because we want this to be some kind of a secret threat. I don't know how much sense that makes, but the point is all that kind of stuff seems to me ought to be open. For somebody who wants to get along with some other committee member or wants to invite her or him over to lunch or go bowling or something like that, all that stuff ought to be allowed, obviously. And there needs to be no public, there needs to be no requirement that all joint bowling be public. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
No, I'm drawing a distinction.
Although we'd be discussing it if it had been an idea.
What I'm doing is I'm trying to draw a distinction here between caucuses, which are meetings, and where there are multiple voices and so on and so on, and the situation where you've reached a crunch where, you know, somebody who's been delegated the idea of you're in charge, you're our leader, has to get together with somebody else who says, well, I'm a leader of the opposite party and we're going to have to get out of here and this is what we need to do. Now,
sure.
At that point, to say, well, let's sit in a hearing room and have our discussion between the two of us.
No, I think the way that sort of thing works and everybody recognizes that you go out of the building, you watch the squirrels, you go down to the park, you go have a beer or something. I mean, that's how that's done, and everybody knows it, and nobody would expect the whole phalanx of legal women voters to follow these two or three people.
I don't know.
Well, as they discuss it.
Ask them. Don't assume that.
Commissioner Schutte.
Yes, my hope would be that while we've agreed to carry forward 061 and are continuing to discuss 092, that we would simply carry forward the notion that we do need to discuss this role about openness and the sunshine.
Yeah, I think that's carried through in 61.
I'm not sure it is, and that would be my concern, okay. Is just about the caucuses. And so I think a rewording to be sure that that concept is discussed in full, not just about the caucuses, but...
So, Administrator Tabor, if you could kind of reword 61, make it one proposal that covers openness and sunshine.
Right.
Kumbaya.
There you go. Thank you. Then we can have the discussion that we're...
Number 104 is next on the list. It's a general statement of a fine purpose, which is make legislators more accountable and accessible to the people they serve, which I think is inherent in the charge to this commission. If there's no one that disagrees, I think we can drop that from Mm-hmm. From further discussion. Proposal number 106 was to increase the power of the citizen advocate. The background is a member of the public suggested more power should be given to citizen advocates in the general public, which is an awfully broad...
I'm sorry, I don't understand what citizen advocate does.
There is a position in the governor's office which is called citizen's representative, and they're full-time job is to be ombudsman or ombudsperson for the average Joe or Jill who has a complaint with the state agency, I think. But I don't know if they were confusing that with that. But I think citizen advocates are, we're all citizen advocates. Mm-hmm. I think that's a too broad, too general statement.
And, scratch that.
Scratch that one off. Number 135 is to establish a public lobbyist corps. Public people available in the building monitoring hearings and other meetings. They would be accessed by the public to make presentations on their behalf or facilitate the public access process. Background, a member of the public suggested for a member of the public to testify before a committee of the legislature, it often requires most of a day for the trip to Salem, appearing before the committee and returning to home or work. In my experience is about half of such trips are wasted because the committee schedule too many bills and fail to complete their agendas in any event. This strongly discourages public participation. And sometimes a potential testifier does not know whether the bill will be of interest. And sometimes comments by earlier witnesses or members of the committee beg for correction or refutation. They suggest a public lobbyist corps, or PLC as they call it, would be at the hearing armed with a laptop computer and either wireless internet access or cable into the nearest Ethernet port. Wow.
Well, it's certainly an intriguing idea, but my guess would be, my impression is that function is already fulfilled by a couple of different institutions, if you will, or one of them is the lobby,
mm-hmm.
and the other one, hate to say it, but is the press,
right.
To some extent.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure that establishment of yet another branch of the government makes a lot of sense.
I wholeheartedly agree.
So I would drop it without too much.
Commissioner Boone.
And I tend to agree with Commissioner Herring, too, because this is a function, and maybe I don't think I'm alone in this because I've seen other people do it, but as a representative, it's incumbent on me to, if I have a constituent who wants to testify and can't right. make it, or it's dicey whether the, as you say, the bill would be heard that day, and that's very frustrating for someone. In my district, you're at least 2 hours away.
Right.
And so we've just made it in our office a policy. They can send us a fax, a letter, a phone call, email, or whatever, and I, either myself or my staff would read it into the record and try to answer questions on their behalf, but advocate for them in that way. Because, this is an intriguing idea, but you'd have to have pretty broad group who's constantly
exactly.
updating their information and research, and it would be tough for them because they might be they might have 7 to 100 people who want their services in any given day, and just the toss of the stars where these bills will be assigned and times, and this person could just go nuts.
No, and as for people coming to testify from long distance and the hearing gets moved, as much as we'd like to, I think it's the charge of this commission to legislate courtesy or common sense, or to mandate courtesy or common sense. That's in.
That was going to be the second piece of my.
Yeah.
But a lot of these things are based on, and I have to admit, this was an unusual session, and it had a lot of opportunities for people to be frustrated or ticked off or whatever. And I'm going back to the nepotism thing. And things go along for a long time, and I remember Jeannie Markham, and heck, if you wanted something to get done, you told Jeannie.
Mm-hmm.
She killed Bill.
Yeah.
But you got to use common sense, and Representative Worth's actions don't represent all of us. And I think that was a very unusual situation. And most of the people I know in this building who are representatives or senators are here because they want to serve the public, and they do the best they can.
All right, so I think it's safe to say that 135 is...
No more.
Not to, as he said, the Ether port. Ether port. Proposal number 47. A member of the public suggested integrity as it relates to agreements made between Republicans and Democrats, perhaps involving binding contracts.
A long time coming.
Wow, yes, another big ambitious idea, but one that this commission certainly doesn't have the ability to deal with, discuss binding contracts between Republicans and Democrats. So I think unless anyone objects, 47 is can be eliminated from our further discussion. Item number 72 is to establish and enforce a dress code or provide uniforms for members and staff.
I'd like to see who designs the uniforms.
Dress code, so. Representative Boone, would you like to be in charge of the attire committee?
I have four outfits to my name, but and everybody's tired of what I wear, but, you know.
But a point on this, again, and I think this is also an issue for common sense. I would say that back in the old days, when I first worked in the legislature, I mean, coat and tie were required on the floor of the House, and things have changed drastically from what I see occasionally.
Yeah, it's recommended, but I know that there's
a house rule.
It is a house rule.
Administrator Taylor, is there a house rule that governs
Mr. Chair,
attire?
There's a committee on your staff summary. There is House Rule 6.01 sub 2, which states, to maintain professionalism in the legislative process, members and employees should dress according to standards of contemporary business attire. And then I also note that there's no similar Senate rule for the floor other than the floor personnel are required to wear uniforms.
Okay.
And my staff used to sit on the other side of the bar and wouldn't come on the floor if he had jeans on, even though he was a pretty nice dresser. Just his own personal thing. I said, it's okay, you know, you can do that, come and get this. But she's right, and there is a dress code among staff, floor staff, and I think it's, oh, Dave's not here anymore, a certain tie, they all have the same tie, and then they're wearing a dark jacket, or they have jackets, I guess, they all match. But I really think that most of us try to do that. For one thing, it's cold, so almost everybody wears the jacket or has something.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
For what interest that they have for the members of the committee, one of the most innovative democratic institutions that have ever been invented followed the French Revolution. And in the French Revolution, there were, in fact, uniforms that for everybody in the government, by rank, including all the members and so on. So, yeah, you could design them. There's a wonderful book that shows what the designs look like. And so if you want to look that up sometime.
But then they all went to the guillotine, and so what could I do?
Yeah, there was a price to pay. I agree with you.
They had to wear wigs, too, didn't they?
What, I was wondering who brought this up and why?
Members of the committee, it's one of those anonymous proposals that we didn't have a name attached to the written comment.
I didn't do it.
Whether there may be some positive impact from doing that, it's not worth the time of this committee to discuss it further.
So we can say that it's gone.
I'm looking forward all morning for the dress code. What are you talking about?
I'm going to get some prior special subcommittee for the subcommittee with Commissioner Herring as the designer. I like this.
And with the book in hand.
Who's our vice chair?
We don't have one.
You're the vice chair.
Okay. What about 073? Don't allow members to leave the floor during session except for restroom or caucus. I think it does have to do, at least from the perceptions and in some cases feeling reality of disrespect to other members of the committee, the audience, the people waiting to participate.
I think this is one of those things that somebody said about something, and it doesn't really, I think, deal with the mission of this group. Nobody in Oregon is upset because, in the public, nobody in Klamath Falls or in Ontario or Coos Bay or Astoria is upset because people of the members of the House or the Senate may, from time to time, leave the room. I don't think that makes any sense. I think we ought to just scratch it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Michael Hand, you are in charge. So.
Actually, appointed to me. Okay. But we are about to.
You notice that the subject was leaving
the corner. Except for restroom or caucus, I like that. They'd have to submit a note to the speaker to that they have to go to the restroom. So, yeah. Now, any objection to removing that from the agenda, okay, Mr. Schutte?
I don't object to removing it, but I just do note that from many people who attend the hearings, and sometimes there are very few people who are listening to the prepared presentations, it is troubling. I think it does impact public confidence, especially from those who are interested enough to be present for a committee meeting, for a hearing. It does have an impact. I don't think we can address it. But
and I would hope the committee chair would take that, would tell the members that. Is it, have you ever seen
committees, I agree with that, because I think that when people come before the committee to testify, that we owe them the respect to stay. And that actually is what got me into this.
But again, that's courtesy and common sense, and not
courtesy,
something that we can.
And the committee chairs, I've never seen anybody say, stay here.
Right.
What they might do is they might say, we're getting very close to a vote, you might want to hang around. And
right.
The administrator has to go round them up.
Okay. So 73 is up for the discussion. Number 76, another interesting proposal. A member of the public suggested, we elected representatives to do the work of the people. How very sad it is with all the problems facing Oregonians. All they accomplished is a law protecting us from goose liver pate and cold medicine. Again, a nice, you know, I'm sure, well-meant statement, but nothing that this committee is not going to ban further discussion of goose liver pate legislation. I think it's another one encompassing our mission.
It is encompassing our mission, because I recognize this sentiment in the little paragraph I wrote about what I might be interested in doing, and that is
to get
traction on the priority issues, and I think that will build public confidence if we get greater traction on.
So 76 is out. 78 is to prohibit alcohol consumption in the Capitol. Crack ran from a Willamette Week article dated September 21st, 05. A member of the public suggested crime victims advocate Steve Dole has offered a modest proposal to a citizen commission looking at reforming the state legislature. How about no legislating while drunk? As this year's session neared an end, Dole and two of his citizen volunteers were lobbying on a bill stiffening the penalties on drunk drivers who kill, only to find that some of the lawmakers they were lobbying were, as Dole puts it, three sheets to the wind. Dole, who won't identify the lush makers, says he's worried about appearances as well as what happens when potentially South lawmakers pass laws. Dole says he's seen it in past sessions in both parties in both houses of the legislature. And I would add that Mr. Dole has discussed this with me as well. Legislative administration has said that alcohol may be served in public spaces by a licensed server with approval of the legislative administrator. The legislative administrator does not regulate storage or consumption of alcohol in private offices of members.
I was surprised when I read this this anecdote that Dole related. And I asked somebody who had covered the legislature for, close to 30 years, Chuck Beggs from the AP, who retired not too long ago. He told me that back when he started, it was quite common for people to have a fifth on the desk and take a nip now and then. But the fact is that the legislature worked a lot better then than it does now. and he had not noticed any particular problem of legislators smelling of booze either, you know, in the building or during the day, that sort of thing. So I think this must have been if this actually happened, I think it was an isolated case. I think we need to worry no more about it, but to rely on legislators' common sense and courtesy and just ability to comport themselves to take care of this.
I would add that this is the topic of the letter the commission received on January 10th from a Jim Santee of Astoria, who said that he has had to deal with elected and appointed public officials, not just legislators, I think he means others as well, city officials, attending meetings in an obvious state of intoxication. And obviously this was an issue with the behavior of Representative Worth, whether or not she was impaired while legislating.
But Mike, it must not have been alcohol.
Commissioner Boone, you know the culture
website. I was there
that
night that Steve Bill was talking about that, and I do remember it very, because I worked very hard to get that bill passed too, and it had the votes. And I think that this was an issue that was very dear to his heart and the people he was with, who were the relatives of someone who was killed by an impaired driver who had killed before. And I know that because it was not in our fire district, but it was in the adjacent fire district, and it shut down the highway for over an hour, and I was right in front of my sister's house where it happened. So I was well aware of that case, and when they testified carrying that bill through the process, the people were there, and I found it really hard to even see the man's family because of that. It was just a terrible case. Half hour before he killed the people, he had been arrested for a DUI, and he was impaired at that point. So that said, he got back in the car, went on, and so this is a very touchy bill. It wasn't the goose liver pate bill, which would have, you know, you'd make a lot of jokes about people being impaired and eating pate. But this was serious, and I think they found it very frustrating that some of the people they attempted to convince or try to convince to pass the bill had been drinking, and so that's probably why this came, I'm guessing, because you can imagine something near and dear to your heart and then not happening. You're so frustrated anyway, you look at anything to pin the blame on. So,
well, on a larger scope, from your sessions and Chair Wilhelms and Committee Member Lang, feel free, you've been around the building a long time.
I think,
is it a problem that this commission should make, or is it best left to...
I don't want to be the one to say it or not, but I think it, you know, we were just talking about this between us. This is another one of those common sense things, and you have to have a sense of trust in people to have enough common sense, and it's kind of self-selecting, because I think you don't want to be tagged as someone who's a problem in that sense.
I would assume could lead to you one being not reelected.
Sure. That's my guess. And so you would think that you'd have the common sense to know that this is a dignified institution and it deserves our respect. And, you know, whether someone has a glass of wine or something in their office is not to say that they're falling down drunk in the halls and in committees. And if that were the case, I would imagine that the chair of the committee would say something and have them leave. You know, and we would try to take care of somebody in that situation, but... I still get back to a common sense thing. I don't think it's good to do that, you know, and it's, you wouldn't want to be real open about it and all that. But and that'd be tough for this committee to, or anybody to police it.
We could mandate, Jenky, that all legislators have Yoshida sauce in their offices. That could be, if they're going to be sauce, they should have Yoshida sauce.
Good idea.
Any objection to removing that from further discussion? If not, then... So done. Proposal number 39, a member of the public suggested review legislative publications, and that was their sole suggestion. Many publications are produced by legislative branch offices. Unclear which publications this comment is directed at. After Mr. Taylor's done discussing with Senator Gordley Wasker for... just on the review and legislative publications, Marjorie, any thoughts on, I know that was the only proposal that came in, or that was all that was offered, but...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was the only statement that the person made, and like I say in the staff summary, there are so many publications that are generated out of this building, I'm not quite sure which ones they would want us to review. But I think this... also goes towards the public access kind of issue that's coming up in the facilities committee. What sort of publications are available to the public?
So another committee is looking at that. So
in
more
a roundabout
less,
way, yeah.
Any objections to removing this from our further agenda?
What we mean by publications, I certainly see it in the proposals that remain in committee suggested list, you know, the kiosks to explain the process to the public. I mean, there are the website, to some extent, we are sustaining an interest in information is publicized for the general public. So I'm okay with removing this, but I wouldn't say that the essence of the issue are we communicating well and effectively? That's what we discussed in facilities, great. But it looks like we're intending to continue to discuss.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and
okay.
Commissioner Trudy, I think that public access being here, you certainly will touch on that. And I think in the facilities committee, we're just talking about public access and how people can use technology to access the legislative process, and whether we need to look at publications on the web there, or are we talking about paper publications, or what publications?
Okay.
I'm not sure.
So 39 is removed. Item number 54, and I know that, or item number 53, excuse me, is next, which is limit passing of notes to legislators on the floor. And no gum chewing as well. I was going to be the next one, but again, this is House rules allow and Senate rules allow, and notes to be passed by pages by the members of the floor. I don't see this as a any impediment to the legislature.
It's personal style and how you do it. I actually, in my case, I don't know if I'm the only one or not, but I asked the sergeant at arms to not bring notes into me unless they were a family emergency or something like that. Because same with committees, I told people I don't like to be pulled out of committees for any reason unless it's an emergency, because you miss the essence of what's being discussed, and it's distracting in that sense too.
If I may speak to that, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Rowland, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, and good morning. My approach is similar to the good representatives. I have a practice of sending the note senders to my staff so that whatever the issue is can be dealt with. It is distracting when you see your colleagues literally jumping up and down and missing the flow of discussion and debate that is taking place on the floor around a given subject. So it does come down to personal style, but I think it also has a lot to do with how we mentor and train is not quite the word I'm seeking, but how we mentor members as they're coming into the process about the importance of being present and what being present means in the conduct of the public's business.
Dr. Schrute.
I really appreciate the perspectives that have been shared, and I would just look at it from the other angle as well. I have talked to many people who were surprised to hear about the note passing and that don't know how to do it and really perceive a power differential among those who are new to trying to create some level of interest in this House and those who are experienced in doing it. So I think it does have an impact on the public process, but again, I'm not sure that's something we should approach.
So 53 removed, and Hasso, I know you're going to be 454, which is the limit press access to members on the floor. Both Senate and House rules allow for press representatives of news media within the bar during floor sessions. As you know, there is a bench in the back of this of both chambers where, and on the side of the chambers where press are present during sessions. I don't see this as an impediment to the image of the legislature or doing something to besmirch the legislature. Hasso?
I would think that unless the reporters riot, it can just disrupt the proceedings. I don't see what harm it does, so I think a limit would be out of line.
Maybe we could limit it to just members of the Albany Democrat Herald.
There you go. Well, that would be a riot, as
Number 57 is to eliminate Senate confirmation of executive appointments. This is a constitutional matter. The Senate confirmation was approved by the voters of Oregon at a ballot measure initiative a decade or so ago. It was discussed and debated at that time and passed by a fairly overwhelming margin, as I recall. I don't know if it's in the charge of this commission to look at constitutionally passed initiatives and try to change them. dicey at best. And for Gordley, and then do you enjoy the executive appointment process?
I think it's part of a good, thorough vetting of public participation in our system of boards and commissions. There's a role for this branch of government to play in this process.
So I think it's safe to eliminate that one without
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Lindy.
Can I just ask Marjorie why that's in this committee?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Lindy, honestly, I don't remember why it was particularly assigned here. It just ended up here.
Senator Gordley, before your arrival today, we did have a discussion on, I don't know if it's an issue for you, with Dave Henderson, who came to testify to us on the issue of nepotism and hiring of relatives in the legislature. Kind of summarizing the discussion for you, I know that Representative Boone, Commissioner Harry, myself, Commissioner Schutte, we all testified on a personal basis or to an understanding of why one would hire relatives and the benefits that they offer from knowing the legislator, knowing the legislative district. We did address the issue with Mr. Henderson about possibly the Kelly Worth situation. Was there a way to address the issue of a legislator raising the salary of a relative? Is there a way where someone, Mr. Henderson suggested the Speaker of the House or President of the Senate, whoever is presiding, that a process be developed where if someone were to raise the salary of a relative, that it had to be signed off, approved, whatever, by the presiding officer? And that's what we discussed. Do you have any thoughts, comments for the committee on the whole issue of nepotism?
I think we have an opportunity to look at the issue even more broadly. How does nepotism, as it is currently practiced in this institution, impede opportunities for affirmative action? We do have a statewide policy which is captured in statute that says that Oregon, through its as a government, shall be a leader in affirmative action. And there's some other language there that the committee may want to take a look at, the affirmative action statute. Nepotism gets in the way of us, impedes our progress in that regard. And I think that's a topic, a separate topic that the committee may wish to examine and hear some voices outside of the legislature to talk about what those issues and concerns are all about. It's clear to me how this practice has come into being, and I'm sure you all have had a healthy discussion about some of those issues. But the broader issue, from where I sit, is affirmative action and how does the state of Oregon function in the 21st century, reflecting the true diversity of the state, if we're hiring our relatives and, you know, how do you get there? A person who could help the committee reflect on this part of the conversation that I'm recommending would be the governor's director of affirmative action, Peggy Ross. That would be a good place to start a conversation.
Thank you. We did keep the whole issue on the committee agenda, and Administrator Taylor, I think Senator Gordley's suggestions and mm-hmm. at a future meeting, that would be a good topic.
I know you've also kept open caucuses on the agenda. I'm glad that you did that. Sorry I wasn't around for the discussion, but if I may say briefly,
please,
Mr. Chair, that I'm a long-time proponent of open caucuses. You know, we're here doing the public's business. This is about transparency from where I sit. This is legislative work. It's difficult, and in the times that we're living in, with the budget choices in front of us and other public policy choices flowing out of the the budget choices. These are hard, hard decisions. And they are the public's business. And the public has every right to know how we are arriving at the decisions that we make. I speak also, though, as one who is not a party, not a product of. I didn't get here as a result of partisan politics. I was a registered independent until 1984, when Jesse Jackson ran for office, and I was attracted to his campaign and the politics of the Rainbow Coalition and the politics of inclusion that resonated for me as a native Oregonian. And so I changed my registration from independent to D so I could participate in that election and kept that choice of registration. But I will also tell you that there was a time last session when I was just absolutely appalled at some of the things going on in our caucus that are about keeping that were about partisanship, and I changed my registration back to independent, and I was ready to walk away from the caucus. It was after some discussion with my sister and other folks that I respect in the community that I determined that no, I would stay. I would stay at the table. I would stay as a member of the caucus. And so I switched back to Democratic registration, but I kept that card, and I keep it in a place where I can look at it and reflect on and remember who I am, how I got here. The journey that brought me here, and why it is I'm here to serve the interests of all of the people who live in my district. And folks I hear from in my district are deeply concerned about what goes on behind perceived closed doors. I didn't come totally prepared to discuss the topic today, and so I'm speaking in fragments here. But again, my overarching concern is that this is the public's business. The public has every right to hear what it is we're discussing, how it is we're discussing it, however messy it might be. They have every right to understand how hard it is to make these decisions. And again, it is their business.
And we did, as you did say, Senator Gordo, we did keep that item on discussion for future meetings. And speaking of future meetings, Administrator Taylor, we've moved pretty rapidly through the list you prepared for us today, and I know you have a suggestion for the coming months for us there.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also in your packet of material, I have a possible work plan for this committee. You'll see that we are at meeting two. And I'm suggesting that you have two meetings between the February full commission meeting and the May full commission meeting to continue discussions about these major topics that remain in committee. Previously, I think we set some tentative meeting dates, April 3rd, July 24th, and October 16th. So I guess one of the questions is whether those dates still work for you, and the next question is whether you would be able to accommodate a meeting in mid-March. Or whether you want one.
Before we get there, I'm going to take advantage, Chairman Wilhelms and Ms. Lang, if you could come up to the table, just for all be helpful to all members of the committee. I know, Jenny, as you know, your committee has some of the big ticket items, and you're meeting in this room following us, I believe. Could you summarize for committee members what your committee has done so far and where you're headed? So. 1 minute, she said. She's going to. While she does that, get started. Chair Wilhelms, from your perspective and Chair Pryor's perspective, how are things going?
Well, I think Mr. Chairman Gary Wilhelms, co-chair of the of the full commission. Thank you for asking. I think that things are going fine and about like we thought they would. I believe that our real work is going to begin to occur following the meeting in each of the committees that's similar to the meeting that you're having here today, where we get rid of the things that we don't want to do, and maybe we take care of passing some of the, if you'll excuse the expression, the low-hanging fruit, and we get that stuff off the table. Then we can turn our attention to a much smaller agenda of probably a lot more important items that are our objectives, for the overall work of this commission. So I think that we're on schedule and things are going well, and I would look for the activity level to pick up. Therefore, I would hope that you could squeeze in another meeting during that time frame and get cracking on some of the tough stuff, because we're pledged to not stop any discourse on any suggestion. I think I told the press at the initial press conference that, yes, we would indeed be a failure if we did not come forward with some significant recommendations. Therefore, I want to get to it and get these recommendations done so that we can pass on them, get them into the final report, and make those recommendations to the legislature. Now, at that point, it becomes a tough sell. Some of these things are going to be a real tough sell because they're not matters of statute. They're not matters of constitutional amendment. Many of them are matters of rules changes. And that's going to be difficult for the majority parties to accept in some cases. So we've got to do a real sales job and a real lobby job. And that's going to fall on some of us to do that. But I'm excited about it, and I'm looking forward to it. But I want to see, I don't know how long the list is going to be, but a strong list of recommendations that we can put forward to the legislature for their discussion. Whether they all, come to fruition, I don't know. I don't know. It's going to be up to the legislature to decide that. But I think that should be our ultimate objective. And in order to do that, we do have to get cracking on some of the more complicated, controversial items. And so I would just encourage you to take that action, Mr. Chairman.
The next meeting is the 13th of February. And,
that's correct.
And you and Judge Pryor and committee chairs will be meeting with legislative leadership next week, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, sir. That's right.
To give them an update on where we are so far.
Correct.
Commissioner Lang, your big ticket committee. How's it going?
So. Jenny Lang, chair of the process committee. We have had three meetings so far, and our work plan has tried to put some of the more complex issues at the top of the agenda. One of those being session structure, frequency, timing, and length. In other words, do we try to go to some kind of an annual session mandated by a constitutional amendment? Do we rearrange the existing two-year period in a different way so that the legislature can meet and have an interim period for committee work in a slightly different calendar than we're currently operating under? Or is status quo acceptable, and do we just keep going with that? So after your meeting today, we will have a committee meeting, and the first item on the agenda is a committee discussion of presentations that we've heard at past meetings about how we would go about that and try to begin to determine where the committee is on that topic, so that by the February full commission meeting, we can come to that meeting with at least a general direction of where the process committee thinks that should be. We're also working on the budgeting process, and the key question, I think, is does an annual session format presume an annual budget, or could you continue budgeting on a biannual basis regardless of how you reshape the two-year period between elections? Today we will also hear the beginning of a topic about who runs for the legislature. What is the legislative assembly all about? The structure, the terms, the number of members, the number of districts. And so we will begin hearing about some of the obstacles or hurdles to running, who runs, who doesn't, why not, and begin trying to flesh out that what is the legislative assembly, what should it look like. And then starting in February, March, and so on, we will hopefully finish the work on the budget. We'll move to some process and purpose topics having to do with bills, amendments, and drafting issues, kind of the guts of what happens during the legislative session, the committee process, special interests, rules, and what we're trying to do is sort of keep track of potential rules changes or recommendations for rules changes as we go, and then sort of work through those recommendations all at once rather than trying to mix them up as we go. So Administrator Taylor is sort of keeping a side list of those items that would be that where a rules change would be required or could make a difference in how the process actually works.
Questions for Chair Wilhelms or Commissioner Lang? Hasso?
No questions.
On here?
Nope.
Thank you. Very helpful.
Thank you.
Mr. Taylor, how would you suggest we proceed? Do we want to open calendars today, or do we want to via email in the coming week?
If you have calendars available today, do you do you have available calendars available?
Well, I don't, but
I don't.
It would be helpful if our next meeting was not on a Friday, is all.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other day is fine.
Then how about this? We'll just set a date by email, and if you're agreeable to setting the mid-March, then I'll do that. But let's confirm that you have April 3rd, July 24th, and October 16th still on your calendar.
Those are previously scheduled dates?
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Fine with me.
Then I'll reconfirm, and we'll establish a mid-March date, and we'll go along with this possible work plan scenario.
As Commissioner Taylor, or Administrator Taylor, as you've seen, has divided the remaining proposals into three broad categories, those being one, public access, two, training and ethics issues, and three, intergovernmental relationships. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I would suggest at the next meeting is continue on with public access issues. No matter what structure this legislature has, you'll always have public access issues. So I think that we can review all of the proposals in committee, come up with any sort of recommendations that you need, move on from there. At the next meeting, then work on intergovernmental relations issues that I know Chair Pryor or Co-Chair Pryor is rather interested in. And again, no matter what structure we have with the legislature, we'll always have intergovernmental relations issues. Towards July, then we can start talking about training and ethics issues. You know, of course, the Oregon Law Commission has the ethics work group that is meeting. They've divided into smaller work groups. Commissioner Lundy is a member of the work group. And I think we need to give them time to work out some of their issues and then hear a response from them about what direction they're going. But we don't necessarily expect anything from them for us to make any sort of recommendations on ethics issues. And then finally in October, I think we need to finalize the committee work and finalize any sort of issues that we want to include in the final report.
Okay. And I'll talk with you, Mr. Taylor. The majority, to me, of the intergovernmental relationship suggestions are those in the broad wish category that we wish counties and states and cities could all work well together, gosh darn it, which, you know, I don't know if it's, again, within the purview of this committee to make it happen. So we might be able to dispose of those, I think, perhaps in the same meeting as the public access, but in interest of time and keeping this committee on task. Any other thoughts, suggestions from Commissioner Lundy?
Marjorie Taylor just said that the Law Commission's recommendations don't necessarily involve any or don't involve any action by the Commission, this Commission. I don't think that's accurate. There would be recommendations on the side of administration and how to make the system work, as distinguished from the content of the ethics rules, which would require, which probably do go to structural issues, which ought to have the support of this commission.
So noted.
Mr. Chair, yes. Members of the committee, I understand what Commissioner Lindy is saying, but on the other hand, I think that this committee and the full commission are operating separately from the law commission.
Correct.
Yes, we'll share information back and forth, but I don't think that we necessarily have to endorse each other's recommendations, but merely work together.
Yeah.
If you can, great.
If you want to.
There'll be no further business to come before this committee. We stand adjourned.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.